But after a short time, there followed one arrest after another, and in a second trial, we learned of it on Good Friday. While in prison, three further death sentences, together with a number of prison sentences, were issued by the People's Court to Professor Huber, Willy Groff, and Alexander Schmorell. The posthumous papers of a Professor Huber, who continued tireless to work at his studies in detention, both before and after sentencing, contain the following draft of a final statement of the accused. It has been reported that these remarks, or at least their essence, were delivered before the court. Quote, as a German citizen, as a German professor, and as a political person, I hold it to be not only my right but also my moral duty to take part in the shaping of our German destiny, to expose and oppose obvious wrongs. What I intended to accomplish was to arouse the student body, not by means of an organization, but solely by my simple words, to urge them not to violence, but to moral insight into the existing serious deficiencies of our political system, to urge the return to clear moral principles, to the constitutional state, to mutual trust between men. That is not illegal, rather that it is the restitution of legality. I ask myself the following. Kant's categorical imperative. What would happen if these subjective maxims governing my actions were to become universal law? To this, there can be but one answer. Public order, security, trust in the government, and in our political life would be restored. Every morally responsible person would raise his voice in concert with ours against the threatening rule of raw force over justice, against mere arbitrariness over the will to the moral good. The demand of free self-determination of even the smallest national minority has been abused throughout Europe. And no less the requirement that racial and national identity be safeguarded. The basic right of a true community of peoples has been abrogated by the systematic undermining of trust among men. There is no more terrible judgment of a community of people than the admission which we all must make, then not one of us any longer feels safe from his neighbors, no father from his own sons. It was this that I intended that I had to do. For all external legality, there is an ultimate limit, beyond which it becomes untrue and immoral. This point is reached when it is used as a cloak for cowardice, which will not stand up against open injustice. A state which suppresses free expression of opinion and which subjects to terrible punishment every yes, any, and all morally justified criticism and all proposals for improvement by characterizing them as preparation for high treason breaks an unwritten law, a law which has always lived in the sound instincts of the people and which will always have to remain alive. His statements must have ended more or less like this. I have achieved the goal of uttering this warning and a word of caution, not in a small private gathering, but before a responsible authority, the highest judiciary in the land. In order to give this admonition, this earnest plea for a return to right principles, I have pledged my life. I demand the return of freedom for our German people. We do not want to waste our short life enslaved and in chains, though they be golden chains of material abundance and prosperity. You have stripped from me the rank and privileges of the professorship and the doctrinal degree summa cum laude which I earned, and you have set me at the level of the lowest criminal. The inner dignity of the university teacher, of the frank, courageous protester, of his philosophical and political views, no trial for treason can rob me of that. My actions and my intentions will be justified in the inevitable course of history, such is my firm faith. I hope to God that the inner strength that will vindicate my deeds will in good time spring forth from my own people. I have done as I had to do on the prompting of an inner voice. I take the consequences upon myself in the way expressed in the beautiful words of Johann Gottlieb Fichte. And thou shalt act as if by on thee and on thy deed depend the fate of all Germany, and thou alone must answer for it. At that time it was rumored that about 80 people from Munich and other cities of southern and western Germany were subsequently apprehended. Some of these were relatives of the principals, usually quite unaware of what had been going on, who were taken into kinship custody. Kin must be held responsible for the traitor, was the order of the authorities, for endeavoring to stamp out at the root any impulse toward independent political action. At the second trial, held on April 19, 1943, in which Professor Kurt Huber, Willy Graf, and Alexander Schmorell were sentenced to death. An additional 11 defendants were brought to the court. Three secondary school students, Hans Herzl, Heinrich Guter, and Franz Mueller, received jail sentences of up to 5 years. The university students Trudy LaFrenz, Gisela Schüttling, Kate Schuderkopf, and Susan Herzl, all members of the group to which my brother and sister had belonged, were each sentenced to a year in jail. Severe prison sentences of up to life were imposed on Eugene Grimminger, the medical student Helmut Bauer, and Dr. Heinrich Bollinger. Grimminger was an economic advisor in Stuttgart and had long been a friend of my father's. Day in and day out, he had devotedly engaged in passive resistance, helping the oppressed and persecuted and giving financial support to the Munich Action. His wife, Jenny, was murdered in Auschwitz concentration camp on December 2, 1943. Bauer and Bollinger belonged to the group of friends headed by Willy Graf, which for years had been strongly opposed to National Socialism. It is known that Bollinger was preparing for overt opposition by assembling a small stock of weapons. All right, there's more text about further trials. I'm going to read you actually three leaflets of the White Rose, the first one, the third one, and the final leaflet. There is more in the book. There is more documentation, the papers, the testimony, the statements, the accusations brought against the Scholls and the members of the White Rose. But I'll leave those to you. If you want further in-depth, you can acquire the book, The White Rose, by Inge Scholl. The first leaflet. Nothing is so unworthy of a civilized nation as allowing itself to be governed without opposition by an irresponsible clique that has yielded to base instinct. It is certain that today every honest German is ashamed of his government. Who among us has any conception of the dimensions of shame that will befall us and our children when one day the veil has fallen from our eyes and the most horrible of crimes, crimes that infinitely outdistance every human measure, reach the light of day? If the German people are already so corrupted and spiritually crushed that they do not raise a hand, frivolously trusting in a questionable faith in lawful order and history, if they surrender man's highest principle, that which raises him above all other God's creatures, his free will, if they abandon the will to take decisive action and turn the wheel of history and thus subject it to their own rational decision, if they are so devoid of all individuality, have already gone so far along the road toward turning into a spiritless and cowardly mass, then yes, they deserve their downfall. Goethe speaks of the Germans as a tragic people, like the Jews and the Greeks, but today it would appear rather that they are a spineless, willless herd of hanger-on, who now, the marrow sucked out of their bones, robbed of their center of stability, are waiting to be hounded to their destruction. So it seems, but it is not so. Rather, by means of gradual, treacherous, systematic abuse, the system has put every man into spiritual prison. Only now, finding himself lying in fetters, has he become aware of his fate. Only a few recognized the threat of ruin, and the reward for the heroic warning was death. We will have more to say about the fate of these persons. If everyone waits until the other man makes a start, the messengers of avenging nemesis will come steadily closer. Then even the last victim will have been cast senselessly into the maw of the insatiable demon. Therefore, every individual conscious of his responsibility as a member of Christian and Western civilization must defend himself as best he can at this late hour. He must work against the scourges of mankind, against fascism, and any similar system of totalitarianism. Offer passive resistance wherever you may be. Foresaw the spread of this atheistic war machine before it's too late, before the last cities like Cologne have been reduced to rubble, and before the nation's last young man has given his blood on some battlefield for the hubris of a subhuman. Do not forget that every people deserves the regime it is willing to endure. From Friedrich Schiller's The Lawgiver of Lycurgus, Gus and Solon. Viewed in relation to its purposes, the law code of Lycurgus is a masterpiece of political science and knowledge of human nature. He desired a powerful, unassailable state firmly established on its own principles. Political effectiveness and permanence were the goal towards which he strove, and he attained this goal to the full extent possible under the circumstances. But if one compares the purpose Lycurgus had in view with the purposes of mankind, then a deep abhorrence takes the place of the approbation which we felt at first glance. Anything may be sacrificed to the good of the state, except that end for which the state serves as a means. The state is never an end in itself. It is important only as a condition under which the purpose of mankind can be attained. And this purpose is none other than the development of all man's power, his progress, and improvement. If a state prevents the development of the capacities which reside in man, if it interferes with the progress of the human spirit, then it is reprehensible and injurious, no matter how excellently devised, how perfect in its own way. Its very permanence in that case amounts more to a reproach than to a basis for fame. It becomes a prolonged evil, and the longer it endures, the more harmful it is. At the price of all moral feeling, a political system was set up, and the resources of the state were mobilized to that end. In Sparta, there was no conjugal love, no mother love, no filial devotion, no friendship. All men were citizens only, and all virtue was civic virtue. A law of the state made it the duty of Spartans to be inhumane to their slaves. In these unhappy victims of war, humanity itself was insulted and mistreated. In the Spartan code of law, the dangerous principle was promulgated that men are to be looked upon as means and not as ends, and the foundation of natural laws of morality were destroyed by that law. What an admirable sight is afforded by contrast by the rough soldier Gaius Marcius in his camp before Rome, when he renounced vengeance and victory because he could not endure to see a mother's tears. The state of Lycurgus could endure only under the one condition that the spirit of the people remain quiescent. Hence, it could be maintained only if it failed to achieve the highest, the sole purpose of a state. From Goethe's The Awakening of Epimenides, Act 2, Scene 4, Spirits. Though he who has boldly risen from the abyss through an iron will and cunning may conquer half the world, yet to the abyss he must return. Already a terrible fear has seized him. In vain he will resist, and all who will stand with him must perish in his fall. Hope. Now I find my good men are gathered in the night to wait in silence, not to sleep, and the glorious word of liberty they whisper and murmur, till in unaccustomed strangeness, on the steps of our temple, once and again, in delight they cry, freedom! Freedom! Please make as many copies of this leaflet as you can and distribute them. The third leaflet, Salus Publica Suprema Lex. All ideal forms of government are utopias. A state cannot be constructed on a purely theoretical basis. Rather, it must grow and ripen in the way an individual human being matures. But we must not forget that at the starting point of every civilization, the state was already there in rudimentary form. The family is as old as man himself, and out of this initial bond, man, endowed with reason, created for himself a state founded on justice, whose highest law was the common good. The state should exist as a parallel to the divine order, and the highest of all utopias, the Civitas Dei, is the model which in the end it should approximate. Here we will not pass judgment on the many possible forms of the state, democracy, constitutional monarchy, monarchy, and so on. But one matter needs to be brought out clearly and unambiguously. Every individual human being has a claim to a useful and a just state, a state which secures the freedom of the individual as well as the good of the whole. For according to God's will, man is intended to pursue his natural goal, his earthly happiness, in self-reliance and self-chosen activity, freely and independently within the community of life and work of the nation. But our present state is the dictatorship of evil. Oh, we've known that for a long time, I hear you object, and it isn't necessary to bring that to our attention again. But I ask you, if you know that, why do you not bestir yourselves? Why do you allow these men who are in power to rob you step by step, openly and in secret, of one domain of your rights after another, until one day nothing at all will be left but a mechanized state system presided over by criminals and drunks? Is your spirit already so crushed by abuse that you forget it is your right, or rather your moral duty, to eliminate the system? But if a man no longer can summon the strength to demand his right, then it is absolutely certain that he will perish. We would deserve to be dispersed through the earth like dust before the wind if we do not muster our powers at this late hour and finally find the courage which up to now we have lacked. Do not hide your cowardice behind a cloak of expediency. With every new day that you hesitate, failing to oppose this offspring of hell, your guilt, as in a parabolic curve, grows higher and higher. Many, perhaps most of the readers of these leaflets do not see clearly how they can practice an effective opposition. They do not see any avenues open to them. We want to try to show them that everyone is in a position to contribute to the overthrow of the system. It is not possible through solitary withdrawal in the manner of embittered hermits to prepare the ground for the overturn of this government or bring about the revolution at the earliest possible moment. No. It can be done only by the cooperation of many convinced, energetic people, people who are agreed as to the means they must use to attain their goal. We have no great number of choices as to these means. The only one available is passive resistance. The meaning and the goal of passive resistance is to topple National Socialism, and in this struggle we must not recoil from any course, any action, whatever its nature. At all points we must oppose National Socialism, whatever it is open to attack. We must soon bring this monster of a state to an end. A victory of the fascist Germany in this war would have immeasurable, frightful consequences. The military victory over Bolshevism dare not become the primary concern of the Germans. The defeat of the Nazis must unconditionally be the first order of business. The greater necessity of this latter requirement will be discussed in one of our forthcoming leaflets. And now every convinced opponent of National Socialism must ask himself how he can fight against the present state in the most effective way, how he can strike it the most telling blows, through passive resistance without a doubt. We cannot provide each man with a blueprint for his acts. We can only suggest them in general terms, and he alone will find the way of achieving this end. Sabotage in armament plants and war industries, sabotage at all gatherings, rallies, public ceremonies, and organizations of the National Socialist Party, obstruction of the smooth functioning of the war machine, a machine for war that goes on solely to shore up and perpetrate the National Socialist Party and its dictatorship. Sabotage in all the areas of science and scholarship which further the continuation of the war, whether in universities, technical schools, laboratories, research institutes, or technical bureaus. Sabotage in all cultural institutions which could potentially enhance the prestige of the fascists among the people. Sabotage in all branches of the arts which have even the slightest dependence on National Socialism or render it service. Sabotage in all publications, all newspapers that are in the pay of the government and that defend its ideology and aimed in disseminating the brown lie. Do not give a penny to public drives, even when they are conducted under the pretense of charity. For this is only a disguise. In reality, the proceeds aid neither the Red Cross nor the needy. The government does not need this money. It is not financially interested in these money drives. After all, the press is run continuously to manufacture any desired amount of paper currency. But the populace must be kept constantly under tension. The pressure of the bit must not be allowed to slacken. Do not contribute to the collections of metal, textiles, and the like. Try to convince all your acquaintances, including those in the lower social classes, of the senselessness of continuing of the hopelessness of this war, of our spiritual and economic enslavement at the hands of the National Socialists, of the destruction of all moral and religious values, and urge them to passive resistance. Aristotle, Politics. Quote, and further, it is part of the nature of tyranny to strive to see to it that nothing is kept hidden of that which any subject says or does, but that everywhere he will be spied upon, and further to set man against man and friend against friend, and the common people against the privileged and the wealthy. Also, it is part of these tyrannical measures to keep the subjects poor, in order to pay the guards and soldiers, and so that they will be occupied with earning their livelihood and will have neither leisure nor opportunity to engage in conspiratorial acts. Further, to levy such taxes on income as were imposed in Syracuse, for under Dionysius the citizens gladly pay out their whole fortune in taxes within 5 years. Also, the tyrant is inclined constantly to foment wars. Please duplicate and distribute. The last leaflet. Fellow fighters in the resistance, shaken and broken our people behold the loss of the men of Stalingrad. 330,000 German men have been senselessly and irresponsibly driven to death and destruction by the inspired strategy of our World War I private first-class Führer. We thank you. The German people are in ferment. Will we continue to entrust the fate of our armies to a dilettante? Do we want to sacrifice the rest of German youth to the base ambitions of a party clique? No, never. The day of reckoning has come, the reckoning of German youth with the most abominable tyrant our people have ever been forced to endure. In the name of German youth, we demand restitution by Adolf Hitler's state of our personal freedom, the most precious treasure that we have out of which he has swindled us in the most miserable way. We grew up in a state in which all free expression of opinion is unscrupulously suppressed. The Hitler Youth, the SA, the SS have tried to drug us, to revolutionize us, to regiment us in the most promising young years of our lives. Philosophical training is the name given to the despicable method by which our budding intellectual development is muffled in a fog of empty phrases. A system of selection of leaders at once unimaginably devilish and narrow-minded trains up its future party bigwigs in the castles of the knightly order to become godless, impudent, and conscienceless exploiters and executioners, blind, stupid hangers-on of the Führer. We intellectual workers are the ones who should put obstacles in the path of this caste of overlords. Soldiers at the front are regimented like schoolboys by student leaders and trainees for the posts of gauleiters, and the lewd jokes of the gauleiters insult the honor of the women students. German women students at the University in Munich have given a dignified reply to the besmirching of their honor. And German students have defended the women in the universities and have stood firm. That is the beginning of a struggle for our free self-determination, without which intellectual and spiritual values cannot be created. We thank the brave comrades, both men and women, who have set us a brilliant example. For us, there is but one slogan, fight against the party. Get out of the party organizations, which are used to keep our mouths sealed and hold us in political bondage. Get out of the lecture rooms of the SS corporals and sergeants and the party bootlickers. We want genuine learning and real freedoms of opinion. No threat can terrorize us, not even the shutting down of the institutions of higher learning. This is the struggle of each and every one of us for our future, our freedom, and our honor under a regime conscious of its moral responsibility. Freedom and honor. For 10 long years, Hitler and his coadjutors have manhandled, squeezed, twisted, and debased those two splendid German words to the high point of nausea, as only dilettantes can, casting the highest values of a nation before swine. They have sufficiently demonstrated in the 10 years of destruction of all material and intellectual freedom, of all moral substance among the German people, what they understand by freedom and honor. The frightful bloodbath has opened the eyes of even the stupidest German. It is a slaughter which they arranged in the name of freedom and honor of the German nation throughout Europe, and which they daily start anew. The name of Germany is dishonored for all time if German youth does not finally rise, take revenge, and atone, smash its tormentors, and set up a new Europe of the spirit. Students, the German people look to us. As in 1813, the people expected us to shake off the Napoleonic yoke, so in 1943, they looked to us to break the National Socialist terror through the power of the Spirit. Beresina and Stalingrad are burning in the east. The dead of Stalingrad implore us to take action. Up, up, my people, let smoke and flame be our sign. Our people stand ready to rebel against the National Socialist enslavement of Europe in a fervent new breakthrough of freedom and honor. And so were the noble aspirations of those who stood for moral righteousness and had moral turpitude. And let us take a lesson from the pages of history, the White Rose Society.